Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about Indian Market. I'm delighted now to welcome Cruz Angeles. He is a filmmaker. His film, Don't Let Me Drown, screens tonight at 8:15 at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a film, Don't Let Me Drown, that takes place in New York in the weeks after 9/11. It's a love story between two teenagers, one of them from a Dominican family, one of them from a Mexican family. Families aren't too crazy about it. It is a fantastic film. I just want to say that it has so much heart and so much reality in it. How did you come to make this film?
Well, right after 9/11, my wife and I, who's also co-writer, Maria Topete, we started talking about how 9/11, the effects of 9/11 were, like the pressure that people were feeling was reminding us of what it was to live in a different kind of environment with a similar kind of threat, which is, you know, violence and crime and gang violence in the neighborhoods that we grew up. She grew up in Oakland when it was the murder capital of the country, and I grew up in South Central Los Angeles during the 80s when, you know, they had the whole crack epidemic. And there was this, you know, there was always, as kids, there was always this tension of like, oh, at any point anything can go wrong, so you have to watch your back. There was an affinity to that kind of tension, and then the tension that we were feeling as adults in New York, and feeling like, oh, we're going to get on the subway, you know, at any point, you know, the subway could blow up, or a cab, taxi could blow up in the middle of Midtown, and Maria's at work, or, you know, there was always that hysteria that consumed the city a few weeks after, and, you know, obviously the media and the government exasperated that situation, but it was very stressful, and I was working with some young people, some refugees from Kosovo at the time, and both groups that I was working with, one was an urban youth group, one was a refugee group, and they all wanted to touch on the 9/11 issue, and they wanted to make movies about it. And one day when we were having a little break, some of the boys from Kosovo, the Albanians from Kosovo, were making jokes about the people that jumped out of the towers. And it was the first time where I felt like I took ownership of the city, and I got really offended, and I didn't understand what was funny about it. So I confronted him. I was like, dude, I don't understand why you're laughing. Why is that so funny? It's not funny to me, you know. And one of the kids said, oh, Mr. Cruz, you don't know, you know, during war, sometimes you have to learn how to laugh in order to survive. And, you know, these are kids who had been in the U.S. for 2 months, but prior to that, they had walked 2 or 3 days from Kosovo to Macedonia and had seen their parents get shot, their houses blown up. So they had seen the equivalent or worse than what we were seeing in New York on September 11th. So they, you know, they're coming from war, obviously. And I started thinking about that when I went home, and I started talking to Maria about it, and we're like, yeah, you know, when I was living in South Central LA, if somebody got shot, like, the kids and I, we would go and, you know, we would make jokes about, you know, the brains on the asphalt, because that was the way we would cope. We would have to laugh about it in order to not deal with the reality, because if you dealt with the reality, then it's like being in war. If you deal with the reality, if you don't make a joke out of it, then you walk around scared all the time. And so we started talking about how the only thing that would help you escape all that chaos and madness was, like, you know, daydreaming about that girl or boy that you had a crush on, or falling in love, or, you know, going to your best friend's house and listening to music. And those were the ways you could escape your environment. And so we started talking about how to mesh those two ideas of what it was to live during our context in the 80s, and then how it is for kids to live in New York right after 9/11, and kind of use, inspired by our memory and our experiences, but also by some of the experiences that, you know, that some of the kids that we were working with at the time, and just kind of mesh that into a story and make it about two kids whose families are having a hard time, and somehow they fall in love and are able to help each other keep their heads above water.
The whole question of how you cope with all the different kinds of stresses around you, I mean, one of the families in the film lost somebody in the towers in 9/11. And on the one hand, you survive by making jokes about it. One of the characters survives or doesn't survive through anger, and he's not able to cry and feel it. And so the necessity of actually just sitting down and feeling it and facing it is also something that you deal with in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for us, it was about finding a way for innocence to triumph over, like, this adult chaos, because all the adults in our, I think most of the adults in the film are kind of in a state of confusion, and the kids kind of find an answer to that, because it's their world, you know, and that's what I saw with my kids, you know, it's their world, they have hope, they think things will change, and of course we saw that for our previous election, that a lot of youth mobilized because they didn't want to keep things the same. And because it's their world, they find a way to deal with it. You know, life needs to move on, you know. And so for us, it was always finding a way to have, like, the escapist moments, but also, like the real raw moments that are happening at home. I mean, these kids are surviving, and what they're surviving is, you know, all these issues. I mean, you're talking about, you know, Dionisio, who's a Dominican father, you know, and I feel like machismo is one of the biggest obstacles that we have in the Latino community, you know, and I feel like he hasn't really been able to express any kind of emotions, because expressing any emotions is admitting to weakness.
Especially expressing vulnerable emotions.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think because he feels like that's what a man is, you know, I think it's really kind of a comment on masculinity, and this is unfortunately one of the biggest problems with poor communities is this machismo, because it really affects the kids. You know, for me to have this kind of character, when Maria and I were discussing having this kind of character, having this kind of father, it really relegates the kind of person this young woman's going to be. And she's really not going to trust boys all the time. And she's going to wear an armor to protect herself from people that are like that. And so, I mean, I think also the main character, Lalo, is the opposite. You know, he's more gentle. He's more of a...
the son of the Mexican family.
Yeah, he's more of a, I guess, noble character. Just because he's inexperienced and naive, I guess.
But what I like about the film, and I've watched a lot of films with Latino characters in them made in Hollywood, and most of them are absolutely atrocious, because when they want to have a noble character,
right,
they make him unrealistic.
Right.
And your character, Lalo, yeah, you can call him noble, but he's a regular guy.
Right.
And he's got the same foibles and ego and everything else that all of his friends have. He just has this heart which opens up when he sees this girl.
Right. Well, we worked hard on trying to make him real, not perfect, because I feel like there is, as you said, in Hollywood, non-Latinos misrepresent us, and sometimes represent us in a very negative light, and hardly ever in a three-dimensional way. And then there's filmmakers that come along that want to represent us in a more positive light, and I think... they go the total opposite way, and they idealize us to death, because
cliches about romantic.
I mean, we're not perfect. If characters don't have flaws, then they're not human, you know. And so that was one of the things that we were adamant about. Some of the cursing in the film, some people have complained about it. Oh, you know, they're young kids. Like, that's the way they talk. This is the way they talk, you know. But deep down inside, these kids are not bad people. They're just survivors within this very kind of bad context, you know, which is, you know, sometimes living in an urban environment. And, you know, sometimes in the urban environment, everybody seems to be, you know, either you have, like, a super good character who's just, like, the saint in the neighborhood, or you have the drug dealer. And we wanted to capture the people that are in the middle, that are not either or, that are just kind of like the real, like, street level, around the way folks.
Who are basically, whose character, not their mannerisms, but their basic character, is equivalent to any high school kids, whether they be suburban or street or anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that was really important to us, too, is that as a filmmaker, forget about all the labels, Latino filmmaker, American filmmaker, the thing that I always strive for is to try to reach for the universal first, because if somebody in Japan or somebody in Africa, you know, in one of the countries in Africa or in Asia, if they don't understand my film, then I feel like I failed, because I made a film that is very local. And when you have a film that's very local, you're not really using cinema in the best way, because I feel like the picture, the visual is the universal language. And when you can make a movie and in a different language, like, you know, I was influenced by filmmakers from India, Sajid Gray and Kurosawa, like, just blew my mind when I saw their films. And there's some of the filmmakers that inspired me to become a filmmaker in the first place, because when I was watching their movies, I wasn't really thinking, oh man, I don't really understand this, I don't know anything about samurai culture or any of that. I knew that this guy was hitting on some very big themes. And so for us, in our film, it was always about love in the time of chaos, and about laughter and love being medicines for survival. So we were always trying to focus on that first, but, you know, also try to have the integrity and authenticity of the neighborhood. Otherwise, the people from that neighborhood are going to be like, oh, this is real cheesy, that's not the way we talk, that's not what happens. And we didn't want that either. But yeah, the hope is that people from any walk of life, any young person could see this movie and be like, oh yeah, I get that, you know, I fall in love like that, or I've gotten my heart broken like that. And so we try to figure out, you know, really touch on the bigger issues, I guess.
I would say that it succeeds very distinctly in all the ways that you're saying. We're talking to Cruz Angeles about his film Don't Let Me Drown, which is screening tonight at 8:15 at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. One thing that I think is also really worth talking about is the cinematography, which is understated in a lot of ways, but it really points out, amid the stresses that these young people are living, these moments of beauty, you know, these vistas of New York and this patch of water or of vines growing and covering a wall. And the fact that the viewer, at least this viewer, recognizes that, it feels like it was intentional, and that these kids themselves are able to see these moments of beauty in their own lives.
Yeah, I mean, when you grow up in a neighborhood, you don't know anything but the 10, 15 block radius that you lived in. And for you, there's beauty in that. And I always feel like, for the most part, sometimes when filmmakers from outside of an urban environment represent that urban environment, they always make it really gritty and dirty and ugly. And I want to try to do the opposite. I want to try to make it lyrical and poetic and hopefully beautiful. Because even though the space is in some ways destitute and squalid for certain people, for the people that live in that neighborhood, it's not. It's their neighborhood, and there's something beautiful about it. And I wanted to try to capture that. I think also, I kept going back to 400 Blows, this movie by Truffaut, and when he made that film, there was a certain connection, I guess, because it was like, what's going on with the adults in that family are affecting this kid. But he also made a movie about Paris, and he made kind of a poem to Paris, the way he captured Paris. And I just felt like, if you're going to make a movie about 9/11 in New York, and New York is not a character within the film, then I just felt like there's something beautiful about capturing New York, and then always seeing the skyline in the background was very important, because it's like this constant reminder that towers are gone. And when I was going through the few months after that, that's what I kept seeing. I mean, I really became a New Yorker.
Yeah.
I think that event really made me a New Yorker, made me appreciate the place where I was living at a lot more and the people there.
There's another theme that runs through the film, although it's not the main topic of discussion, but one of the characters' father works in the cleanup, and they're not given dust masks, their health is suffering, nobody cares about it, then they're not even always paid for their work.
Yeah, actually, we developed a script at the Sundance Lab, and some of the advisors in 2005 were like, do you have any articles about this? And Maria and I were like, no, we have not. There's nothing about it. In 2005, there was nothing about it. Now you can find articles about the firemen, you know, and the conditions of the fire and certain workers. But the way I found out about it was through one of my kids. He got recruited. And he was telling me, yeah, man, they got Ecuadorians, they got the Mexicans, they got the Dominicans. None of the waste management people want to go down through the holes, and the police and the firemen are not getting along. But because, you know, the Latinos are short, they're sending them all down there with the dogs to look for people, and they got them cleaning the... And then I got involved with this, because there was also Chinese and, you know, Asian workers being hired to clean up the mess. And you know, I found out through an organization that some of the workers that were working there were people that actually worked at the towers, and they didn't know what to do the next day but to go back and clean up. So they got recruited by these contractors who were paid by a subcontractor. I mean, the city was paying for this, right? But there was, like, so many firewalls of, like, trying to find out who's your boss that some of these workers just got really... I mean, all the extras that play workers are workers that worked in the towers. Some of the women that were in some of those shots were telling me that they were sent through the AC vents to clean up with a vacuum. And some of their colleagues who were in this group have died.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of gunk that they were breathing in an unprotected way, I mean, you show that very clearly in the film, is just staggering.
Yeah, there's a group called Latin American Workers Union out of Queens in Bushwick. And I worked with them, and I told them what I was doing. And at first they were hesitant, but, you know, they read the script, and they was like, okay, this is important. We need to be part of it. But some of the stories that we heard on set of those people were, I mean, it was like some of the other workers were crying just to hear what some of these women were put through and some of these men were put through. And some of their members died from the same things that some of these firemen died, which
right.
is...
And we hear about the firemen, but we don't necessarily hear about these workers.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's that's the way it is. You know, we go to war and only certain soldiers get attention.
Right.
9/11 happens and only certain people are heroes. And so I think that was part of the point that we were trying to make without hitting people over the head politically, that in a small way for Marie and I, Ramon is a hero, you know, because he's working there. He's helping people, you know, and he thinks he's doing something really great. And he's kind of noble, kind of like his son. But in some ways, he's also naive, you know, because he really truly believes in this American dream. And then at the end, you know, it's like he's just invisible.
Cruz Angeles, how did you cast the film?
We casted all the parents, all the adult roles through a casting agent out of L.A. We were fortunate enough that the people that we wanted... We didn't have to beg or do anything special to try to get them. They just loved, they really responded to the material. And I think that's really important, is to have a strong script. And thanks to Sundance, we wrote a lot of rewrites. So, you know, Sundance really helped us get the script out in the best possible way, get it to the best possible point where people would be interested. But all the young people we casted ourselves because we needed to do a grassroots approach. So we went out to the streets, we passed out flyers. One of my friends, who's also a board member of NALEAP, Nada Martinez, was very instrumental. She sent out a viral email, and she knows a lot of teachers in the school district, and she kind of got the word out, and we did an open casting call, and 400 people showed up. You know, it's like a line outside the street, and four other boys we discovered from there, including Jonathan, who plays the cousin, who I think is really great.
He's very good. Every young person in that film is very, very good. And this little firecracker, young Dominican woman who plays the teenage girl.
Yeah, Stephanie. She came. Her name is Glendile Sinoa, and she is Dominican from the Bronx. And she basically came with very little experience and didn't have the best audition, but it was really frustrating because it was like, I would say cut, and then I would see my character, Stephanie, and then I would say action, and it would turn into something else. It was a little bit more like high school acting, you know, in my opinion. And when she stepped out the door, I told my producers, you know, including Maria, I was like, that's Stephanie. And they were like, no, there's no way, you know, like, they're real hesitant to cast her, and it took a while for me to convince them, but I worked with her for about 8 weeks.
How did you work with her? How did you draw that performance out of her?
Well, you know, I worked a lot with actors before I went to NYU. I worked in theater a lot, and I acted myself. And so, you know, I feel like when you have a really great actor, like the guy who plays Ramon, the father, Lalo's father, I didn't have to do anything. You know,
yeah.
I always feel like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just let them do their thing. When you have excellent actors, usually it's less work for you. But when you have an actor who's starting out, you have to kind of guide them through the whole process of becoming the character. And we did a lot of workshops and with them and a lot of rehearsals and really did a lot of soul searching and trying to figure out how she could apply certain, you know, her own instrument, emotional, physical, you know, to deliver some of these moments, you know, and after a bunch of work and just bonding and having trust, because trust is really important. If you don't trust your director, it's, you know, it'll be very self-conscious, you know. I mean, focusing on the moments and breaking down the moments just like any other actor, beat by beat, is what we did. It's like I did this with young kids. Sometimes you feel like, oh, yeah, you know, you got young kids, just have them improvise, they'll be brilliant. But that wasn't the case. I mean, we had really great kids who could improvise really well, but when you're trying to deliver emotion and psychology, improvisation is not always going to help you, you know, unless you have a genius actor and it'll work. But we worked for 8 weeks, you know, just like I work with any other actor. It's like we just slowly developed the character. We went scene through scene, and we explained, you know, that there's a reason for everything. Your a character's coming into a scene with a certain amount of baggage. Then they come in, and somebody says something that changes that, and that's a beat. And, you know, it was kind of rehearsal / acting class.
Yeah, yeah.
With her.
Before you even turned on the cameras.
Before, yeah. I mean, I videotaped a lot of the rehearsals, and, you know, the thing that she brought to the table that I just couldn't find, we saw at least 200 other girls, because, you know, because people were not, you know, including my casting director, wasn't confident about. I mean, they were right. It was a risk, because you never know. Like, you get somebody new, and even if you rehearse with them, when you have 15 people in the crew and the big cameras in front of you, they could really, I mean, it's a huge risk.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could freeze. So you really have to develop also that kind of, like, confidence with the actor, you know? Like, for me, like, I told both my leads, you don't talk to anybody but me. I don't care whose opinion, other opinion you trust, but I better not see you talk to any of my crew. I told my crew not to talk to my actors at all, like, even the adults, because, you know, sometimes I know as an actor, you're vulnerable, you know? You feel like, did I do well? Is crew's really, you know, is the director really telling me the truth? And yeah. And when you get to that situation, they go look for feedback from somebody else in the crew, and that could really sabotage a performance.
Now, how did you find Lalo, the teenage boy?
We found him in 2005 when we were doing the lab, the Sundance lab. We went to the director's lab, and we got lucky, you know. We had to do casting for those roles because they were young roles, and we brought this wonderful actress, April Hernandez, to play Stephanie, but, you know, she was 25 at the time. And then we found EJ, and he was awesome. He just came in. I saw his headshot. It's weird because I was like, I looked at all these headshots, and I showed the headshot to Maria, and I was like, man, I hope he's really good. I like his look. I think he would be good for, you know, look-wise. I really like his look. And he came in, and he was real charming. You know, he had the charming quality, and he's very much a gentleman, and really, like, read the lines really well. So we knew he had the flavor of, you know, the street. And then he even wrote a rap for Stephanie. So he pulled out a sheet. He's like, can I read? I wrote a rap for Stephanie. And then, like, you know, he read his little rap. And we're like, okay, this kid is good. And then, you know, I took him to the lab. And everybody was blown away by him. You know, Robert Redford loved him. Just thought he would, you know, it's like, because he just came in with really raw energy.
So it takes an independent filmmaker to make a film like this. We're talking to Cruz Angeles. His film is called Don't Let Me Drown. It's screening tonight at the CCA in Santa Fe. How did you put together, I mean, was Sundance behind it financially?
No. Well, you know, what Sundance does is they do everything else but the financing. You know, they develop the script. They make sure that all the advisors are consistently in touch with you in case you need more feedback. And then you go to the director's lab and you try to work on the scenes that you think are going to be the most challenging. And then once the script is ready, once, you know, Sundance feels like, you know, the script is ready to go, then they create the bridge between you and these production companies, and you send out the script. And so they're almost like, in some ways, they're almost like an agent, because they're like, if you don't have your own agent or your own manager, they send out these scripts and they build a relationship so that, you know, you can meet with these people and then you talk cast. And it just happened that all the production companies that we met were just not interested in our project because it was too small and we didn't have Javier Bardem or Antonio Banderas playing the father. So...
Ay, ay, ay. Can't they just get over that?
Well, you know, when you have an actor like Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men winning an Oscar, you know, that's who they want. So, and you know, Benicio del Toro meant something to them, and we actually thought Benicio would have been great, and you know, we went out, but it was really difficult because it was like it was all about cast, and it's really frustrating because as a director, you have these actors who are like, just cast me, I'd be great, you know. And it's embarrassing because you're like, yeah, I know you would be great. You'd be perfect. You're probably actually the best person for this role, you know. But then you go and meet with investors and production companies, and they think differently. And
so then how did it end up happening?
Well, it just ended up happening at some point. Maria and I decided to go through our list and say, look, we can't get the money the way we want to, so we're just gonna cast who we think would be great for the role. And then we casted some of them, and it just happened that we found private equity. We found people that wanted an executive producer credit and had extra cash, and, you know, they didn't have a production company. Their first film was going to be Don't Let Me Drown. And
wow. That's amazing.
That's the way it happened, through private equity. I feel like a lot of independent movies get made in New York because of that, because of all the money's there.
Yeah.
You know, you have Hollywood in L.A., but you don't have a lot of private equity, and if you do, most of that private equity is trying to get into the studio system. So we were very fortunate that somebody read the script who, you know, smart enough to see, like, this could be a really good film, and they knew that it had to have a certain level of authenticity, so it had to be casted in a certain way, and they were just very supportive in that way.
Well, it's time to go, but I want to thank you very much for being here with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Cruz Angeles, director, producer, writer, filmmaker. The film is called Don't Let Me Drown, once again at the Center for Contemporary Arts tonight at 8:15. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome John Torres Ness. He is Director of Artist Services at Indian Market, and Jane Davis, who is founder and director of Hope House, who has a booth this year at Indian Market as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So Indian Market is a great big destination for people from all over the world. It's a huge event for the artists who are participating in Indian Market. Your role as Director of Artist Services is not just about the many things that are being exhibited, but it's really a kind of people role.
It is, and I often, people ask me, what do you do? And I often said, I'm an artist juggler. I juggle 1,500 native artists from all across the country and help them get to town, help them get their booth locations, help them through the whole jurying and judging process. And you meet all kinds of amazing people.
So I can imagine that just the competition to get a booth in Indian Market in the first place is intense. How does that work?
Well, we start out in the fall, actually. We're already well into 2010's show and planning. So applications go out end of September, beginning of October. Artists send in their application, their images, their slides, and we go through this rigorous juring process to select about between 900 and 1,000 artists.
How many applications do you get?
This year we had over 1,500 applications.
Okay.
So there's still 200 on the waiting list and another 200 or so that just didn't get in at all. So.
And do you select for not only quality of work, but for a kind of diversity of work so that a lot of different bases are covered?
Both, and we try to cross, you know, gender and age lines, and we try to make sure we value the elders that have been here for a while, even though the work may not be, you know, number one quality anymore. People want to come see them now. It's not so much about their work, and try to honor that balance between contemporary artists and those that have made this market what it is.
When you say those who've made it what it is, are you talking about more traditional types of work?
Traditional artists, people that, you know, their grandmother and great-grandmothers have been in the show, mostly potters, mostly jewelers from the Southwest.
Now, does Indian Market cover beyond the Southwest?
It does. I mean, we are the Southwest Association for Indian Arts, but a good 20% of our artists are from all over the country, Alaska, Maine, just from all over.
Give us kind of an overview of some of the things that people might see at Indian Market this year that they aren't expecting. Okay, pottery and jewelry, as you've said.
Pottery, jewelry, lots of paintings. When I came on to market last year, my goal was to figure out how do we honor all the other Native artists, filmmakers, poets, performing artists. So last year we added a film component to the show, and this year we're adding poets and literary artists to the show. So those are two things that people may have not normally seen at Market. Also, we're having demonstrations on the booths on the plaza again this year. So we've got a sculptor and a painter and some basket weavers from Maine demonstrating their crafts from further away that people wouldn't normally see. Northwest Coast, Alaska, a painter from the Southwest, but a very contemporary painter.
How many of the people who come to Indian Market with the intention of buying are collectors or gallerists or people who are working really in the trade, so to speak?
How many of them?
Well, I mean, is that a large percentage of it?
Certainly the early birds, it's the huge percentage of it. Those folks that are waiting outside the booth at 7 a.m. on Saturday, often many of those collectors that want a specific artist's work literally pay people to spend the night in front of the booth overnight. And so there are those collectors that are serious. And then usually Sunday afternoon we get a lot of the wholesalers, the gallery people who buy wholesale from artists before they go home. So it's very early Saturday morning, and then usually Sunday afternoon are the two big professional groups that come in to buy work.
We were talking recently to the New Mexico Women's Foundation, and they have their annual Rag Rug Festival. And for many of the women who are showing their crafts and their work that weekend, a large percentage of what they make is that one weekend. Is that
right?
The same in Indian Market?
Absolutely. Most of our artists will do two shows a year. They'll do Indian Market here in Santa Fe, and they'll do the Herd Show in Phoenix, which is, you know, based on our show. It's almost as old as our show. It's about half the size of our show. And with those two shows, that's their annual income. Some people, it's the one show they do a year. I talked to a potter this morning, and she's got all her pots ready, and this is her, you know, she makes her whole money. She won't sell another pot till next August.
I would think that artists, Indian artists, especially working in traditional media, are always walking a fine line between really expressing traditional crafts the way they've been made for many years and selling for the market, making things that people want, you know, wealthy people from Texas and California and that
right.
kind of thing. How do they find that balance?
I think it varies from medium to medium. For instance, 2 years ago, the Best of Show winner was a bead worker. So last year we had lots of beadwork entries. People saw what was winning awards the previous year and really tried to tune their work towards that. The more traditional textile artists and potters, they just continue doing what they do because that's what most people want to see. I mean, they want to see a pot look like it did 100 years ago.
Right. And are they still made in the way that they were made 100 years ago?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, still, the clay's all still collected naturally and polished. Some folks have gone to kiln firing and then pit firing. They'll kiln fire first and then pit fire because it reduces the amount of breakage. But other than that, it's pretty much the same way.
And you are from the world of anthropology, is that right?
You're an archaeologist. Yeah.
So what's your specialty in archaeology?
Actually, it's stones. Stone tools are my specialty. And I was a lead archaeologist for the Navajo Nation, where I'm from, for about a decade. I got a curator job here at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe. And when I came on board there, they hired me as the archaeological curator. And during my interview, the director said, "What do you know about contemporary Native arts?" And I can learn. And so my first 8 shows there happened to be all contemporary Native art shows. I didn't do a single archaeology show while I was there. And I started volunteering with SWIA, got really involved, and suddenly decided, you know, this is much more interesting dealing with living people instead of all the not-so-living people.
So the written word poetry and so on is part of it, too. In fact, we're going to be speaking with Simon Ortiz on the show,
great.
I think, tomorrow.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, he's our headliner for our
right.
show.
But that's a new piece
it's
of Indian
new.
Market.
We're starting that Wednesday. Indian Market used to start Saturday. We actually are starting it pretty much Tuesday this year. So
it's just more opportunity for people to come and
just more to see. The films are running. Just, you know, the poetry thing. We're having a big press conference tomorrow morning with a governor proclamation announcing Native Arts and Culture Week for the whole week.
And so you, Jane Davis, we're talking to Jane Davis and John Torres Ness about Indian Market, are the founder of Hope House, and you have a booth this year devoted to Native prison art.
Yes, we're so thrilled and thankful that our paths crossed with John, and he just grabbed it and ran with it and got it, and actually also became a Hope House volunteer. So he's been coming in the prison. I actually brought some art that we're going to be displaying for the radio audience.
Yes, we're going to hold it up to the microphone, as always.
But, you see we have these are paños, which is a traditional prison art. And these were painted, drawn by Native American inmates.
What does the word mean?
Paño is now I forgot what the word means in Spanish, but what it is a handkerchief. That white handkerchief that many prisons sell. And then you can see the creativity. They really just do it with whatever they have at hand. This particular one is a black ink drawing, and they made it fancier by shredding so that
fringing
there's fringe.
The edges of the but they're images basically drawn and painted on handkerchiefs.
Exactly. And this one you see, obviously they had access to colored pencils, and so most of them are black and white, but you do get the color. This one, this box, was hand-carved by a Native American inmate in the federal prison. And we've been working with Native American inmates and others for 16 years. So someone made us this box with the blessing that it should always be filled with donations.
Oh, nice.
Wherever we have. So that box will be there at the market.
How do you connect with prison artists?
Well, we go into the prisons. So it's part of the work that we do by showing up in the prison. And our work is not issue-oriented or political. It's the human beings. And I think that's why John and I connected, because our work is about the human beings who live in there, who they're doing their time, they have to be accountable, but we don't get involved in that aspect. And our belief is anything that we can do to bring dignity and respect to a human being is maybe planting a seed that will have an effect when they come out. This opportunity is absolutely incredible because it's giving hope to not only the self-help group that we work with here in the penitentiary of New Mexico, but we're getting the word out to Native American inmates all over the country, because I've been going in there, so I'm spreading, and hopefully next year we're going to have, you know, even more art. And we've got quite a lot. The banner that was created, that John and his folks created, if you notice, it has no date on it. So I'm like, yes, we can hang it next year.
But it's a Hope House at Indian Market banner for about prison art.
Prison art,
and I've seen quite a bit of prison art for whatever reason, either shows of it or whatever. Always has a look. You can almost tell that it's prison art. What's that about? Is it something?
Well, because I think what it shows is they don't have much access to craft things to make. For example, this is a smudge stick, and you can tell by the wood, by the way this is made. Like you
Jane
can tell
Davis thinks that the radio audience can see what she's holding in her hands, ladies and gentlemen, but they can't. She's holding up a piece of wood.
That you can see from this. This is a typical...
It's a simple piece of wood.
Simple. See, I knew you would find the words for it. And yet the feather and the smudge is complex. So they had access to a lot of things in this prison. And I think prison art shows the ingenuity of every human being. When you take things away, the prison art is just so rich and full of humanity and hope. John, what would you say? You've been coming to the groups.
I've just been amazed at you know, the art for those folks really comes from a different place, because they'll take the tiniest bit of a pencil that they have left and still manage to draw something amazing. It's just this need for creative expression is there regardless of the fact that they have hardly any materials.
Right.
And it's amazing, amazing.
And also, I mean, as we've discussed on this show and in other places, there are a lot of people in prison who are creative types, right brain learners, not necessarily super verbal, incredibly gifted, who weren't recognized in school, went down a bad path, And there they are.
Yes, and what you'll see, the painting we used on the banner is by an inmate, Joey Allen, who was part of our group for years, the Gray Eagles in the penitentiary.
Now, what's the Gray Eagles?
The Gray Eagles is the Native American self-help group in the penitentiary. And Hope House sponsors three of the five self-help groups. We also sponsor the Black Awareness Group, the Gray Eagles, and the Haciendalas, which is the Hispanic self-help group. And so Joey is now what's called off paper. In other words, he finished all of his time. So this opportunity is also giving him hope and a chance to actually earn a living, even though we will not be selling art at the market.
Oh, you won't?
We're just exhibiting. And it's really to educate the public to the human beings behind the walls and to see the creativity, and it's that spreads. Now, Joey, for example, will have an opportunity to get commissions if people, and he's one of the most incredible artists. He's
coming
down.
Yeah, that looks like an 18th or 19th century European narrative painting.
He's talented, and one of the things that he did in prison was he taught others how to paint. And so he's been very instrumental in supporting other inmates and teaching them. A lot of the art that you see, the inmates never did anything artistic before. And that's the other amazing thing, is that all of a sudden they're locked up in prison. You know, they're deprived of certain things, and the art and creativity just shines. And I'm hoping we're going to be at Cathedral Park in booth number 9 across from the tent.
Okay.
And I'm hoping lots of people will come by and see us.
So are there people who, I mean, you're not selling it, but are there people who collect prison art and exhibit prison art in galleries, whatever?
There are a lot of people who collect prison art. And Hope House, we're actually talking to a gallery in Madrid, and we're hoping soon to have a space where we will be representing some prison artists from all over the country, because we can't sell, because we're in as volunteers, so we can't get involved in business relationships with the inmates we actually work with. But those who come off paper, who were finished, like Joey, who's finished with the system, he will have an opportunity, and perhaps he'll have his own booth next year, or perhaps Hope House will have a co-op where we'd have both the nonprofit, but also maybe be able to sell prison art from around the country.
John Torres Ness, what do, when there's a disproportionate number of Native people in prison in a lot of states, just as there are a disproportionate number of Black and Latino people in the United States, when people come out of prison and they have to be reintegrated, what do you, for example, you're a Navajo, what happens?
That's tough. I guess that's sort of why I kind of wanted to get involved with this, because I know a lot of times people go back home and they're faced with the same situation, no employment, in the middle of nowhere, and it's hard for folks to really get back on their feet in a lot of cases. And I saw some of the artwork that these guys were doing and realized that they had not seen Indian America. They had not realized that you could make a living as an artist, and that's something you can do back home in your community. You learn how to fill out your applications, you know how to jury and photograph your work and get into these shows. And that's sort of what I'd hope to kind of be involved with here. Because it is important for a lot of people to go back to their communities as part of the healing process. But then they also have to have some kind of economic incentive to really get back on their feet. And I see so many Native artists be able to do that successfully. And that, well, this is a good way to introduce these folks to market and see 1,100 people making a living at this. Some people still living in big cities, but most people just doing their craft in their own communities and being able to do that.
And it's not only a way of making a living, but it also is in itself kind of a, probably a healing or calming activity
for
them.
Yeah, absolutely. For instance, you know, beadwork is one of those things that just takes a long time to do, and it's very soothing and very methodical and meticulous. And
if you haven't learned patience before that...
There you go.
There you do.
I think that's one thing these guys have figured out.
One of the things that I want your listeners to hear is, if anybody out there has friends or family who are serving time now, Native American inmates serving time now, or out. And I would love them to be in touch with us so that we can start collecting and gathering for next year's show. And I'd want the word to spread among Native American inmates, no matter here or wherever they are, that they have an opportunity to show. So they can reach us at on the web, www.hopehouse.org, and that's HOPEHOWSE.org.
And tell us what the Hope House stands for.
Hope House is an acronym, and it stands for Help Other People Evolve. That's the hope, through honest, open, willing self-expression, self-evaluation. And so it's a spiritual action that tells you you have to be really right with yourself first and honest, and then the hand in the logo, the eye, the heart, the hand, is to be of service. And that's essentially Hope House is of service. No one, including myself, as founder and director, earns any money. And and then also when it comes to raising funds, we always have such great things going on that I end up forgetting we're fundraising and end up inviting everyone. And that's really, you know, we've existed as a 501c3 for 16 years or something, and it's encouraging people, be present and be of service no matter what comes in your path. We're all one, and our logo's One Heart.
It's an unusual nonprofit in that it doesn't have one specific set of areas that you serve. You kind of serve whoever and whatever comes along, whether it be dogs, prisoners, teenagers.
Correct. Right.
Somebody you meet in the supermarket.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, it's interesting because this month I got three letters from inmates from Bangkok prisons who happened to get chicken soup for the prisoner soul and read about Hope House, and I have a couple of stories in it. So they sent letters, and they didn't know each other. They were from three different prisons. And then also I got a call the other day from a man whose son is going to prison in a month, and he's from the East Coast, and he called so we could be of service in helping him and connecting his son with others who are now out of the federal system. So, again, you're so right and astute, Mary Charlotte, that we are about being of service as a path to peace, and we are not defined by anything except that.
And you seem to sort of keep it all in balance. I mean, if I were in your shoes and people were calling me for help night and day, way more than any one person or even group of volunteers can handle, I don't know, you seem to somehow make it all work.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's the mystery of, you know, what we call the creator or higher power, or I call it it with a capital I, because I do have a full-time job. So I work 40 to 50 hours a week in that. And somehow when I wake up and continue to wake up at 3 in the morning, I'm so charged by being of service that's when I do the Hope House work and emails. And I once heard an expression, if you want to get something done, ask the busiest person you know.
That is so true.
It is true.
I hate to admit it.
It is. And you know, so we just flow. And I think the reason that I can do it is I have no illusion of helping anybody. So there's no, I'm not fixing anyone, I'm not helping anyone, but I'm fully present. And so when something comes in my path, you pay attention. You either do it or don't do it.
We're talking to Jane Davis of Hope House and John Torres Ness, who is the Director of Artist Services at Indian Market this year. Now, Indian Market starts today, Tuesday, August 18th.
Correct.
And runs through the weekend. So much going on. People can look at swaya.org. Swaya is spelled S-W-A-I-A. Any particular things that you're most looking forward to?
Good question. I guess I'm most excited about the literary component we're having this year on Wednesday night. It's at the St. Francis Auditorium at the Museum of Fine Arts. Just because I'm glad to have spoken word as part of Indian Market. It's a free event. Again, free films all weekend long on the plaza. Native filmmakers from all over. So I guess those two I'm really excited about and proud of, just because I'm trying to continue to... I guess the performing artists are next. How do I do that? I don't know, but I'll figure that out.
Right. And then, you know, what's interesting about that is once you get into poetry and spoken word and performance and things, yeah, you can sell books and tickets, but it really expands it away from a consumerist, let's sell merchandise to
right.
people, to more of a cultural festival.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's lots of Native stories out there to tell, and some tell it by making pots and some tell it by writing books. And,
yeah.
and they're both equally important.
Well, John Tarsness and Jane Davis, thank you both so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very Mary much. Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.